with worry, slyly slipped a tin of a stewing steak into the paper bag at her side. And her face was white with fear in case her actions were observed.
Hi, I'm Nikki Maida from the Waylon Jennies, and you're listening to The Ivory Tower on CKUW 95.9 FM.
And now, live from the Ivory Tower, CKUW 95.9 FM, in the heart of downtown Winnipeg, I'm Kelly Hughes, so buckle up.
Well, buckle up, babe, buckle up, gal. Have a drink, girl, I'll buy another round. One microphone and a Dixieland sound. Keep one in your pocket and your shoes on tight. We've been buckling down tonight. We'll settle up, partner. Saddle up, pal. Dig your heels in and hurry on into town. Got a travel man and a bar room full of gals. You might leave alone, you might meet your ride. We've been buckling down tonight. And our address in the corner, staring at your eyes.
Good afternoon. I am Brother Kelly Hughes, Chaplain of the Arts. I'm broadcasting live from the Ivory Tower, CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg, Manitoba, Canada. Also, CKUW.ca worldwide and into space. Space. It is 1:03 p.m., 25 degrees and clear and hot and sunny. Thank you very much to Kit. She's going to be back in a couple of weeks. Next week in the leadoff spot, I presume that we have Nicole. But for the next 117 minutes, you've got me. So let's try to get along. And you've got my guest, too. My guest is a columnist, a writer, an author, but mostly a drummer. My guest, Tom Broadbeck. How you doing, Tom?
I'm great, Kelly. Thanks for having me today.
Thank you so much for stopping by. I'm sure there's other things you could be doing today, mowing your lawn or
playing drums.
you have a book that's coming out. It's not out yet, and it's coming out. Tell us about it.
This is a book called Treaties, Lies, and Promises, and it's about the Red River Resistance, the Métis' role in Manitoba's entry into Canada, its contribution to Canada, and the numbered treaties, the first numbered treaties that Canada signed back in the 1870s. And together, it really tells the story of how Indigenous people contributed to shaping Canada and bringing Manitoba into Canada. But it also talks about how Indigenous people were mistreated and dehumanized, and it's the whole story together that I think people need to read about, or I think would benefit from reading, because it tells the story of things that happened all within a few years, right here, right in Manitoba, and I touch on other numbered treaties that extend into northwestern Ontario and a bit into Saskatchewan, but that's the nub of it.
When did you first have the kernel of this idea?
So it started with a series of feature pieces I wrote for the Free Press. So as we were approaching 2019, the 150th anniversary of Manitoba, I pitched to my editors the idea of doing a multi-part series on the Red River Resistance, and that we would follow the timeline of 1869 to 1870, so 2019, 2020, starting with the beginning of the resistance, the blocking of William McDougall at the U.S. border, the provisional governments that were set up, and then ultimately the delegates that were sent to Ottawa to negotiate Manitoba's entry into Canada. A year later, as we were celebrating the 150th anniversary of Treaty 1, which is the very first numbered treaty that Canada negotiated with First Nations, I pitched to my newspaper that we do a big feature piece on that, and they let me do that and gave me a considerable amount of space. After it was all over and doing all the research for it, I thought, geez, you know, all of this stuff kind of happened at the same time, and they're interrelated, and I found a lot of crossover between the two. And I thought, I started thinking about the idea of a book, and that's how it started.
So now the book, when does the book come out?
October.
October.
Yeah.
So this week you announced that you were having a book launch in the fall at McNally Robinson.
Mm-hmm.
And then what happened?
And then what happened is there were some people on social media that said, wait a minute, what about all that stuff you wrote 10 years ago when you used to work at the Winnipeg Sun, which was some pretty nasty stuff and some pretty hurtful stuff against Indigenous people? And I got called out for it.
So now I need to know this. Were you surprised?
Not really. I mean, I always knew it was there, and it's something that I should have addressed a long time ago. And I was called out for it, and that kind of forced me to deal with it. But it is something I should have dealt with a long time ago, and I didn't.
So you just kind of thought, but I just am wondering what you were thinking. Like, you thought, you know, I've written this book, I'm going to announce it.
Mm-hmm.
And but were you surprised? I mean, did you think your post was going to be kind of innocuous and you weren't going to, you know, you're going to get some attaboys? And I mean, were you surprised from that perspective of how mad people were?
No, I'm not surprised at how mad people were.
Yeah.
They have a right to be mad. They have a right to be upset. They have a right to call me out. They have a right to not accept my apology. They have a right to be angry about it. Absolutely. The stuff I wrote 10 years ago caused a lot of harm, caused a lot of hurt. It fueled racist sentiment among a lot of people, including non-Indigenous people. It caused a lot of harm. I have to be accountable for that. I have to stand up and explain myself and apologize for it, but start doing the hard work to try to help with the healing.
And you wrote a column on Thursday, I think, where you talked about some of this stuff here, and I thought it was a good column. Did you decide to write that column after kind of the initial backlash?
Oh, absolutely. Or? Yeah. I wouldn't have written it without being called out. I mean, I was called out last week on social media, and I responded to it.
Yeah.
As I said earlier, I should have written this a long time ago, and I didn't.
Yeah.
So no, it was only because of that.
Why do you think you didn't? Because I mean, you've changed your views. Like, I mean, you know, when I've read your stuff in the last number of years on the Free Press, I've said, well, this guy's not so bad. And certainly, you know, when I read your columns in your previous columns in the other paper, I was like, what the fuck is wrong with this guy? You know, so I mean, obviously you've had some kind of a change. Why is it? Because you're a writer, you're a communicator. How come you never addressed that until
That's a good
week?
Question. I don't have an answer for it. The only thing I can say is I should have, and I didn't. I went through a transformation. The more I learned and researched, especially for the feature pieces that I wrote for the Free Press, and then the research I continued after that to write for my book, I went through a transformation. I changed my views on many things to do with Indigenous people as I learned, as I reflected and reevaluated my positions on these things, I changed my views on it. And this has been a slow process that's occurred over the last 6 or 7 years. Mm-hmm. And so then there's this old stuff you wrote that's sitting there, right?
Yeah.
And I
because it never goes away.
It never goes away. Yeah, it never goes away. It's there. It's on the record. I have to be accountable for it, but it's there, you know? And I should have addressed it, and I didn't. And I waited to be called out before I did it.
So were you just sloppy and intellectually lazy, or like what's the
I would say so.
Yeah,
I would say so.
Because I mean, I understand, you know, I've as a middle-aged white cis dude, you know, I've had to change a lot in the world. But I think that the changes, you know, for me have been sort of more subtle, because as you admit, I mean, some of your stuff before was, you know, quite gross and hurtful and whatever. I mean,
it was awful. Kelly, when I read it now, I cringe. I'm embarrassed by it. And because I went back and read a whole bunch of stuff that I wrote back then after I was called out.
Yeah.
And I'm embarrassed by it. It's awful stuff. It's terrible. It caused a lot of hurt, caused a lot of harm. And I cringed when I read it. And it's not me today. And I read this stuff now and I go, I can't believe I wrote that. It's awful. It's terrible. It's crap.
Don't put too fine a point on it, Tom.
Well,
I'm glad to hear this, because I feel like we need to have a mechanism for people to do better. You know, I know that people talk about cancel culture and whatever, and I don't. I think that people have always sort of boycotted and spurned people that they didn't like and who, you know, were kind of, you know, abhorrent or didn't, you know, whatever. Like I mean, I think that's always been around, but. I feel like there's also lots of fake apologies flying around, and you know, sometimes people just disappear for a while and they come back, like Louis C.K., or, you know, it's obviously a different situation. But I just mean, it seems it's rough, like it's hard. It must be hard for you to figure out how you're going to gain people's trust.
Oh, absolutely. It's extremely hard, and I understand the anger out there, and I understand that some people aren't going to accept my apology, and I understand that some people think I have ulterior motives, and I completely accept that. I have to embrace that. That's part of the process.
Yeah.
I mean, you can't get into the stuff that we're getting into, writing a book on it, writing an apology for crap that I wrote 10 years ago, being part of the reconciliation process, without getting into the muck. This is hard stuff.
Yeah.
This is hard stuff, and I'm going to take hits.
Yeah.
And I'm going to take more hits, and I not only accept that, I embrace it. It's part of this process. When people think of reconciliation, it's not just a bunch of words. It's not just, checking off a box that you did a land acknowledgement at your public event and then you can walk away and do nothing else. We have to do the work. I have to do the work. I have to do the work. And I have a lot more work to do, and I have a lot more learning to do, and I'm going to take a lot more hits for all of it. And when the book comes out, I'm going to continue to take hits. But I think at the end of the day, what I'm doing is going to have a positive impact, because I'm trying to get information out to people, both Indigenous and non-Indigenous people, about the stories that we don't know much about in this province and in this country. We know very little about the number of treaties. We know very little about what the Métis did here to bring Manitoba into Canada, and how they were treated afterwards, and how First Nations were treated after the treaties were signed, the lies, the failure for governments to make good on their treaty obligations. We know very little about that. When we go to a hockey game or a Bombers game or some other public event and there's a land acknowledgement, and we talk about being on treaty land and the traditional homeland of the Red River Métis, most people don't really know what that means. You know, when the little kid's tugging on his mom or his dad's coat, mom, dad, what does this mean? Dad doesn't really know.
Well, and does dad care sometimes, right?
I don't know. So. But I think that's a good question, but I think people's curiosity has been piqued in the last few years. There's been an awakening in Canada. The unmarked graves, the realization that as a country, we've kind of ignored a lot of things, and we've not understood our real past, and people are starting to become tuned into that. So do people care? I think they do. I think people want information. I think people want to know more because they really feel like they're in the dark, because people like you and I, when we went to school, they didn't teach us any of this, and they're starting to now in the public school system, and that's great, but we need to do far better. But people like you and I have such a lack of knowledge on this stuff, unless we've gone out on our own, or maybe you've gone to university and you've taken a lot of courses and you've taken it upon yourself to do it. But without that, it's not in the public consciousness, and it's time for us to put it in the public consciousness.
Well, and I remember when I was like six, we had a hoop dancer come to our school, and he took questions after, and I... you know, was raised in a suburban family of kind of, you know, I mean, we'll call it casual racism, which is not really, but, you know, I think people can sort of figure out what that is. But I had heard the same kind of things, even up to being just, you know, only 6 years old, about Indigenous people. And this fella asked if we had any questions. And I'm not going to say what I said to him on air, but I asked him like a completely innocent question, which was super offensive. But I didn't know, because I had just heard, you know, I had heard these things being not really directed at me, but like I'm in the car and, you know, I'm just there and these adults are talking about these things. And I think people generally now know the things that they shouldn't say. And I think people are generally more politically correct with their language, because even the people that I know, most people that I know that are homophobic will now say LGBT and then say whatever offensive shit they want to say and kind of a little bit of a, you know, shine it up a bit. But do you think, you don't think that in some way, though, we are more polarized? You know, you look at the Freedom Convoy, and you look at the the internet has opened up a Pandora's box of various people with opinions that would never be heard otherwise, like somebody leaps to mind. Is it Jaime Weinstein? Do you know who that is? The guy who talks about the no mass graves and all that stuff, you know. I guess he's a
residential school denier.
So, but, you know, and he's sort of all over the internet, and, you know, probably you wouldn't hear from a guy like him before. So what about these people who read your old stuff in the Sun and liked it? Are they going to read this book?
And they heard, and I heard from them this week.
What'd they say?
They didn't like it. They like the old Tom Brodbeck. I mean, you know, and
you're not making anybody happy.
And that didn't surprise me either, right? I mean, I'm not going to change their minds. You remember Jim McRae? I mean, Jim McRae is a former Attorney General of Manitoba.
Oh, yeah,
he's a
right?
residential school denier, and I've gone back and forth with him. I'm not changing his mind.
Yeah.
You know, there's nothing I can do about that. I still think the majority of people are open-minded and want to learn and have a level of compassion and want to know more about it. Yes, there's polarization on a lot of other issues as well, and on this. And I was reminded of that this week when I wrote my apology, and I heard back from a lot of racists and a lot of people who, you know, were hitting me from the other side. And I can't do anything about them, but they're a minority. I really, Kelly, believe that. I really believe it's a small minority in society. I believe the majority of people are compassionate, want to learn more and care, because that's what we're talking about here. Do you care?
Yeah. I hope you're right. I hope you're right. And I generally live in a bit of a fishbowl, because, you know, on social media, I block people that are offensive and people that I don't like. And, you know, so mostly the people that I'm interact with on social media either agree with me or they don't say anything if they don't. Mm-hmm. Because I can't, like, I had one run-in. Physical run-in out in the street with the Freedom Convoy when they were slow rolling down Selkirk Avenue, and I just you know, I was waiting for my helper. We were going to go to a moving job, and I'm sitting there waiting at my car, and I start yelling at these guys, and they start yelling at me, and there's just this whole thing. And then I realize, and then somebody honks at me, and I realize I'm standing in the middle of the street. Somebody going the other way has honked at me, and I'm standing in the middle of the street yelling at these guys, and because I just got so upset, you know, for a million different reasons, so I hope that people are capable of change, and I hope that, you know, there are more people than not who just need to maybe hear the good news or the good word, you know, the gospel of the truth, right? Sorry, I know you didn't want to talk about Jesus, but but you know what I mean.
I think people are. I think, and I mean, I got a lot of emails from people who, you know, said, you know, I've got to confront my past. I got to rethink some. I'm not proud of some of the things I said when I was younger, but it's not on the record in a newspaper, online somewhere, or on a microfiche in the library. But I have to reevaluate some of the stereotypes I've had, some of the thinking, some of the things I've said I'm not proud of. I had a lot of people email and tell me that. So that's encouraging to me. And I mean, I have no data to back it up or empirical evidence, but my gut tells me, from being in the business that I'm in and talking to the people that I speak with and the feedback I get and others, that the majority of people are interested in changing their views and are interested in knowing more about the issues around Indigenous people, about treaties, about Manitoba Métis Federation, etc., because they know that it relates to issues, that very, very difficult issues that we have to deal with today. Everything that happened 150 years ago that developed into today is relevant to the issues that we're dealing with today. And you can't really know what's going on today if you don't know the background, if you don't know the history. You don't really understand the stories, and including the positive ones, like now you're dealing at the Capion Barracks on Keniston. I mean, that's a positive story, but to fully understand it and appreciate it, you have to know the whole background in the history of Treaty One, because that's what it's related to. And it's fantastic stuff. And some people are afraid of it. They don't know what it is. Yeah. And it's because they don't know the background and they don't know the history of it. And I didn't a few years ago either.
And I think people don't necessarily, they don't want to make the connection between with historical things and what's happening now. They don't want to take responsibility. You know, people say, well, I don't have anything to do with this. But, you know,
but they do, because they benefit from the society that we have today, right? And they like me, have privileged positions in society and life because of all those things. And they don't realize that part either. And that's part of the conversations that we have to have, that we're all in this together and we're all responsible for that. And the fact that you've got this privileged position in society has very much to do with the last 150 years of how this country developed. Some people will never accept that. I get it. They will balk at that. They will reject that. And they're not interested in having that conversation. But I still think most people are. I'm optimistic anyway that most people are.
And I think, you know, we benefit from it. And also, I mean, we're not, you know, that far away from it. My grandfather was a lawyer. He worked in Hugh John McDonald's law firm. Hugh John's dad was John A., who we know about him in residential schools, you know, so there's, I'm, you know, closer to that than I am to Kevin Bacon. Right.
Yeah.
And I think that, for about the last 10 years, I've lived in a very poor, neighborhood. That's the second poorest in the whole country. And, right by the, Siloam Mission and Union Gospel and all that stuff. And I have, I've always been a compassionate person. I've always been an empathetic person, but I have really had to look at people as individuals and not as, you know, a monolith, like, oh, these people, you know, how we other people and we say these people.
We stereotype.
But each of these, you know, like I, this guy, just little things, like this guy was really trying to get down to Roseau River to pick up a check that he got, a settlement check or something, and he couldn't get down there. And so he paid me to drive him down there, and we had a, you know, 3-hour car ride, or how, I can't remember how long it is, and he told me all about all the things in his life. And, you know, like, looking at this guy. I mean, he was just this ratty looking guy with one eye, and you know, but he had this. He had a life just like everybody else. You know, he has a name and he's got this life and all these different interesting things that he's done and things that you wouldn't really guess about somebody. But, you know, people have so much going on. And when we just say those people, that really we do a disservice to everybody. But, I mean, I was kind of right there and, you know, sort of confronted with that. And I kind of had to do that because I was kind of right on top of everybody else. And I think for some of us, you know, with the flight to the suburbs, you know, it's pretty easy to I have different helpers, and sometimes one of the helpers I've had for my moving stuff that I do for a long time is Indigenous. And when we go somewhere like Charleswood, or, you know, not to pick on Charleswood, but certain places, I mean, people look at him differently. And there have even been times where people will come up and ask what we're doing because he's there, you know? So even for me to realize that I walked through the world in a totally different way, being a, you know, middle-aged white guy than so many other people, and I'll never really understand how they walk through the world. You know, the cops are never going to stop me and say, you look like a guy that, you know, we got a call and you look like that guy, because, I mean, I just look like the cops. I don't look like the guy. I think that we'll never understand. You've obviously been writing a long time and in the media for a long time, and you've had a lot of feedback, but how does it feel to be the story right now?
Oh, it's very uncomfortable. Yeah. You don't like it. You know, I mean, it's been a tough week. There's no question about it. But you know, the discomfort that I feel is, you know, nowhere near the pain and hurt that Indigenous people have felt from the stuff that I wrote. So I have to keep that in mind all the time. It's not a comfortable feeling this week, that's for sure. I'm usually writing about others. I'm usually writing about politicians and governments and courts and cops and holding those institutions accountable. And it's a lot easier writing from that standpoint because you're sort of always in the right, you know, when you're an opinion columnist, or you think you are, even when you're not. and I get it wrong a lot. And that's just how... you know, that's just how the industry works. When you're writing about yourself and you become the story, it's very uncomfortable, but this is a necessary process. Yeah. I think in the end it's going to be constructive and productive and helpful. Because there's many other people like me that are in the same boat as me that need to confront their past, need to confront the attitudes and stereotypes they've had, need to, whether they're writing for a newspaper or whether they're not, speaking among them, their friends and their family. And these are conversations that we have to have. It's going to take a long time because we're trying to move this big ship.
Yeah.
We're trying to move a big ship in this country, and you're not going to turn it around overnight. And it's going to take a lot of time to move it around, and it's going to be tough, and it's going to be mucky, and it's going to be ugly sometimes, and it's going to take a lot of hard work. This isn't easy stuff.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, I agree that, you know, that there are lots of us that need to, you know, think about the things that we've done and figure out how to do better.
I'm not trying to diminish my situation saying, you know, there's a bunch of other people like me, so somehow it's okay. I really want to make that clear. The stuff I wrote 10 years ago was awful stuff, and I have to be held accountable for it.
Yeah.
And I have a privileged position that I get to write for a newspaper, and with that comes responsibility. And I don't want to diminish or take away from that at all.
Now, well, then let's talk about now. I mean, do you... like I said, lots of us need to think about what we've done and do better, but do most of us need to write a book about treaties? Like, are you the right guy to write that
book? Well,
I
mean, most of us can't do that, right? Yeah. And most of us aren't writers and have access to the things I have access to. And I was lucky enough to get a book deal, which was difficult and not always easy to do. Mm-hmm. And I'm grateful that I did. So sure, not everyone can go out and write a book about it, but people can read, whether it's my book or others. There's lots of material out there. There's you know, there's a ton of material out there to read if you're interested. Yeah. Listen to, read, watch, have conversations, listen to this show, talk among your friends. I mean, you know, confront your friends and your family when you hear, you know, racist stuff, when you
that's
hear
why
people,
I don't go to Christmas dinner anymore.
Well, you know, so and so that's interesting you should say that, right? So, you know, and so how much do we retreat from it and how much do we take it on? Because taking it on, it's hard, right? Retreating's easier, taking it on's hard when you're sitting around with your buddies and people are saying things and you don't say anything, compared to speaking up and saying, you know what you're saying there is pretty racist and pretty harmful and pretty hurtful. You should think about that.
Do you think you are in, I mean, as a you know, as a white middle-aged guy, are you in a good position to talk to other white middle-aged guys?
Oh, absolutely. You know, and hopefully that's part of my hope, is that I can influence people's thinking, and through education, through information, through communication, book, otherwise. I write columns. I speak with a lot of people, but I mean, obviously it's through my writing that I can reach a lot of people because of the position I'm in, that I write for a large broadsheet newspaper.
So what would you say to the people that say that you're not the guy to write this book? It's already written.
Totally,
so.
Yeah. And totally fair comment. Yeah. I accept that. Yeah. You know, there are some people who believe that no one should write about Indigenous issues if they're not Indigenous. And I accept that. I accept that's a valid criticism. It's a valid point. I may not necessarily agree with it because I think I can reach people that may not that may not read this stuff otherwise, I'm lucky enough that I have the skills and the connections and the resources to have written this book. Yeah. And I think at the end of the day, and I'm not here to promote my book. I'm here to talk about my apology, and I'm here to talk about other issues. But you asked me about the book, so I'm telling you that I think it'll reach a lot of people, and I think it'll do a lot of good because people are going to read it and go, oh, that's what happened. Yeah. I kind of starting to see the connections now.
Yeah.
Because right now, very, very few people know about these stories. Very few people make that connection. And honestly, they're actually really interesting stories. Mm-hmm. I mean, the negotiations of treaties, the Red River Resistance, and the subsequent negotiations with John A. MacDonald and Georges Etienne Cartier in Ottawa, the passage of the Manitoba Act. It's really the armed insurrection, the blocking of the Lieutenant Governor designate William McDougall at the U.S. border.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's riveting, dramatic stuff. And most people in this province, in this country, know very little about those stories.
Yeah.
They're quite interesting. It's interesting stuff to read about. So it's not like you got to, you know, read through 1,000 page books of academia to learn this stuff. You can learn it through the stories and have a much better idea of how we got to where we are today and the developments that occurred along the way. And I think the more people know, the better they'll understand the issues that we're faced with today in society, and they'll be hopefully more compassionate, more understanding of the different efforts that are now being taken to address these.
Aren't there lots of people that have written about this kind of stuff, like J.M. Bumstead? And
they've done some. If we're getting into the weeds on my book now, which I didn't want to, but I mean, I think mine.
We'll throw you back out into the open water in a second. Yeah.
You know, my book is one of the first ones, if not the only, that takes the treaty negotiations and the Red River Resistance and writes about them together, because I found that there was a lot of overlap and that they're intrinsically linked and that the stories should be told together because it all happened around the same time. And it's also written in a very easy to read format so that I think anyone can read it. It's not an academic book. It's not a peer reviewed book published through a university press. It's written for a general audience so that anybody could read it. A kid could read it, a teenager read it, an older person can read it. Anybody can read it quickly.
Okay, so we're definitely not promoting the book.
No, we're not.
But we are having to talk about the book here for context.
Because it's related.
That's fine. We don't have to pretend the book doesn't exist, because that's the whole thing. there's a couple of things that, you know, I've just screenshotted a couple of things that people have just posted on on my social media. And, you know, you've acknowledged that there are people that are going to say, well, you're not the guy to write this book. And you and I understand that the guys that look like you and me have been sucking all the air out of the room forever.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a problem.
Yep. 100%.
One person said, has he and his publisher committed to donating any profits made? And I know most books don't make that much money, but on principle.
I'm going to have more to say on that in the future, and I'm not going to give you the details right now.
Okay.
And that's a very valid question.
Yeah.
Absolutely. 100%.
Well, that's a good answer. Now, Kevin Sheaf wrote the foreword.
Mm-hmm.
Are you friends, or did you just
ask him? Yeah, we're friends. We've been friends. So Kevin and I, we first met when he was an MLA and a cabinet minister. And so we met through work, right? I covered the legislature as a journalist, and that's where we met. And we got to know each other during those years. But we became friends a lot closer after he left politics. It's hard to get too close to politicians because it's a bit of a conflict.
Yeah.
But you do get to know people, contrary to what some people might believe.
Also, they're super busy doing their own. They're in their own world.
But you can't write about people unless you get to know them. I had to get to know Gary Doer when he was the premier, because I can't write about him if I don't know him. And so we would have a lot of exchanges outside of the normal interview process. I had to get to know Brian Pallister in order to write about him. And we had a lot of, chats in the hallway and chats at, press gallery, Christmas parties and whatever else. You have to get to know people and kind of figure out what's inside their head if you're going to write about them. He was a very interesting fellow.
The first time you met him, were you surprised at how tall he was?
I knew him in the mid 90s when he was a government services minister under the Filmon government. That's where I first met him. Yeah. And then he kind of left for a while, and then he ran federally and whatever. But he's tall. you look up to him, at least physically.
Has Kevin Sheaf had any words of advice for you in the last week?
Absolutely. We talk almost every day. Kevin and I are pretty close, and Kevin's an incredibly wise man and a good friend. And I get a lot of advice from him, and I've learned a ton from Kevin. And I was absolutely honored that he wrote the foreword, and it's phenomenal.
Have there been any other specific people that have kind of helped helped you with sort of, repairing your thinking, or, becoming a better person, or, anybody?
Nobody really stands out. I mean, I've spoken to lots of Indigenous people and leaders, and I've interviewed people over the years, and I think it's, the collection of all of that together. Kevin definitely stands out.
So then, and this is another thing that, let's talk about social media. Mm-hmm. So now you everybody's on social media. It's just a fact of life, from Tila Tequila to Stephen King, everybody's got to use it. But that's not really your medium. Your medium is, kind of longer form stuff in the newspaper and traditional legacy media. But you have to be on, the socials, because that's where you have to be. Yeah. What is your general opinion about social media? Do you hate it?
First of all, I don't think everybody's on social media. Tons of people are not on social media.
When I say everybody, I mean like a lot of people.
A lot of people, But sometimes those of us who are on social media a lot live in this social media bubble that doesn't necessarily reflect the real world.
Yeah.
What is my opinion of social media? I got off Twitter because it became so toxic and gross. Yeah.
Cesspool.
I couldn't stand
it. Absolute cesspool.
It's a cesspool, and I had to get off it. I was on it. That was the first social media platform that I kind of got involved with, because it was sort of newsy, right?
Yeah.
You know, whatever, 10 years ago or whatever.
Yeah.
And you would use it for work too, right? I'd promote my columns. We'd engage. We'd have conversations. I used it constantly, right?
Mm-hmm.
But it deteriorated over time. And it became a cesspool, and it became a place where you would hear, just constant, racist tropes and misogynistic tropes. And it's just, I had to get off it literally, and I just canceled it.
Yeah.
So I'm on Facebook, I'm on Instagram, but I don't use it much for work. I use it for music because I'm a musician and I play in a band and I use it mostly for that.
So what about, there are a number of people that have said that you blocked them on social media.
And that was
women, indigenous people, CBC producer
Sunday.
Leonard Monkman.
And I did. That was my knee-jerk reaction last weekend when this happened, and I was defensive about it, and it was a mistake, and I've unblocked it. I'm pretty sure I've unblocked everyone, and I certainly did unblock Leonard, and that was a mistake, and that was a defensive reaction that I had.
Yeah. Is that a thing? Did you do that when you were on Twitter?
If
you
just I blocked a lot of people on Twitter who were, you know, throwing racist tropes at me and anything that was hurtful, and racist and whatever. I just didn't want to see it. So yeah, I blocked tons of people on Twitter.
Well, but also
for the same reason you do. Did or do
I no I yeah, yeah. sure yeah. And I and I haven't really been on Twitter for a long time either, but more than one person has said that you blocked them about the whole I don't know, when you were backing the current mayor and talking about Glenn Murray. And so were you still on Twitter at the time?
I was, yeah. I wouldn't have I block people if they were, you know,
being mean.
Not just to me, but I mean, if someone's going to write racist stuff and misogynistic stuff and put it into my feed, I'm going to block them because I'm not interested in seeing that. And it became so overwhelming after a while, it's why I got off it.
Yeah.
It seemed there were less controls on Twitter compared to 10 years ago.
Yeah, I mean, it is, when things get out of control, it is rough. I had... I don't know, 2 or 3 days ago, somebody that I didn't know accused me on social media of doing something, sending them a video of myself, and it blew up into this thing for about 24 hours. And then it was, became apparent to everybody that it was not true. But I mean, it was a really rough 24 hours.
That's awful.
For me, because you don't, just. Yeah, like you're not sure what's going on, and there, it has kind of a social media can have kind of, when it blows up, it has kind of a, it's like an avalanche, you know?
Yeah, it's the Wild West, right? And those are the risks associated with being on it.
I had a couple more things that people wrote. You know, some people are nice, some people are not nice. But you know, one person said he could spend the next decade attempting to re-educate every one of his readers who were emboldened by his bigoted views, and he wouldn't come close to undoing the harm his writing caused. His apology now, exactly at the moment when he's worried about his own profits, as someone pointed out, may be genuine, but it's self-serving and rings hollow. So that's not a nice one.
But it's valid, and I accept it. And you know, people have a right to have those opinions, and I completely accept that. And they have every right to believe that. They're applying a BS meter to me, and they have every right to do that. I would do the same.
Yeah. CBC's Unreserved Rosanna Deerchild said, so he apologizes only after being called out, and how will he reconcile with Indigenous people going forward in terms of undoing that harm? And perhaps most relevant, why does he believe that book is a story to tell, which you just answered that second one. But, you know, what do you do? I mean, you can make your apology now and then it, you know, falls off the, not that we're in the news cycle, but you know what I mean?
It's just the beginning, right? And, and it's part of a journey that I've been on for the last 6 or 7 years. And there's going to be a lot more hard work to do. And there's going to be a lot more hits that I'm going to take from Rosanna Deerchild and others. And I completely accept that. And it's their right to do that. It's their right to criticize me. It's valid, completely valid.
Yeah,
I accept it.
Yeah.
And these are the challenges that I'm going to face going forward with this. It's hard stuff. There's going to be a lot of muck. There's going to be a lot of hits along the way. And I completely accept that.
Yeah.
It's necessary. This is hard stuff.
Yeah.
It's not a book about cooking and kittens.
Yeah. Just a couple more things, and then we'll play. Then we'll talk about the new song that, that you're on, the new tune. I'll read a couple of things that are nicer. We'll let you crawl back on shore here. My takeaway here is that it's important to admit when we're wrong once we've learned more about the world we live in. I hope people in the past that read his articles and believed in them as the gospel truth will also reevaluate their beliefs.
And that's important.
Someone else has said his apology is contrite and deserves to be seriously considered by anyone who was right to be offended about his previous position. I wish more privileged non-Indigenous people would see the error of their own thinking, feel sorrow, and demonstrate it through similar ownership of mistakes. As a Red River Métis woman who works in the political sphere, I will read his book and make up my own mind about the conclusions he draws. And then just one more here. Which I'll just end with this here for the for today's readings. Where did it go? I am one of the many Indigenous people he hurt with his privileged, vitriolic writing. I've had to work on my healing for many years, and his pen was mightier than his sword, and it cut very deep. However, my heart is open to forgiveness. It will take some time, but I'm willing to work on it. Now it's his time to do the work of reconciling the harm he's caused to our people. That too will take time, but he must do the honest and sincere work to make right all of the wrongs he caused with his privilege and his status as a writer who influenced many to think of us as less than human. Grace be upon him during his long and sacred journey.
There you go.
Yeah.
All valid points.
Are you a more compassionate and empathetic person?
Oh, absolutely.
Than you were before?
Absolutely. I mean, and as I've grown older and wiser and you have children and you families and I've just become definitely more compassionate and more aware of people around me. No question about it.
Yeah.
And that's part of it.
Now, you don't want any of this. All you want is to be a musician. Everybody, it doesn't matter what they do. It doesn't matter if you're, a politician or you're in the newspaper all the time. Everybody just wants to be in a band. You play with Stephanie Westall. And,
yes.
And you guys just have a song that just came out.
We do. Drive Your Car just dropped yesterday, and it's really exciting and a blast, and Stephanie Westall is a phenomenal singer-songwriter from Winnipeg, and it's her third EP, produced by Chris Burke-Gaffney.
Do you have time to stay for a minute after
Absolutely,
the song?
And
we'll,
for sure.
We're going to play the song, then we'll talk
awesome.
A little bit more.
Thank
the
you.
Song is called... I had it here. This is the problem with college radio. There is no one here to do any kind of production.
I see you're doing everything yourself.
It's me. It's me and my fat thumb. I did find it before. There we go. Drive Your Car. Nope. Now it started. Nope. There we go. It started already. And it's a nice picture of her with a, I don't know.
Sports car.
Camaro. I don't know what that is.
Me neither. I'm not a car guy.
Yeah. Okay.
Are you a car guy?
I am not a car guy. I am Kelly Hughes. This is the Ivory Tower here with Tom Broadbeck. We're going to listen to a tune, and then we're going to come back. This is Stephanie Westall and Band. This is brand new tune that just came out yesterday, I think. And this is Drive Your Car here on the Ivory Tower, CKUW 95.9 FM. Ooh.
Heading straight for the stars. We're gonna go real far. Never gonna be apart. Baby, I wanna drive your car. I wanna drive your car, yeah. We're gonna go real fast. Come on, let's hit the gas. Baby, I'll make you last. Turn it up, let the music blast. I wanna drive your car. Down the highway.
That is a brand new single that has dropped. That is Drive Your Car, Stephanie Westdahl. I'm Kelly Hughes. This is the Ivory Tower. It is 1:50 p.m. and 25 degrees and sunny. I am sitting here talking to Tom Brodbeck, writer, lightning rod for controversy, drummer, and you're playing, you played drums on that. And
I didn't actually play drums on that recording.
Oh, you didn't play drums on that? No, oh, they wouldn't let you in the studio.
Exactly.
You're good enough to play live, but you can't.
There you go. We could have a whole conversation about that a different time, and how the recording industry has kind of shut out drummers, but I don't take that personally either. There are good reasons for it, believe me.
So you love drumming because drumming, as a drummer, nobody is ever mad at you except maybe the bass player.
Once in a while, yeah, unless you speed up or slow down too much. Yeah, you're generally revered, you know, there's not a lot of controversy.
Now, is this part of an EP?
This is part of an EP. There'll be more songs coming out as the year goes on.
What's the EP called?
I believe it's going to be called Drive Your Car, but I'm not 100% sure about that.
Will there be a physical? Do people make physical CDs anymore? They just throw
the stuff out on
Apple, Spotify, and all.
You know, the industry has changed so much over the years, and I was in it a long time ago when we were still recording on tape. You know, how long ago I was in the industry, and it's obviously things have changed so much since then, and including the whole marketing aspect of it, and the fact that everything's streamed now. It's turned upside down. So I'm kind of learning about it again.
How long ago did you start drumming?
Oh, I started when I was 12 years old. Just playing in bars when I was 16.
Back when you could play in a bar when you were 16.
Yeah, well, in those days. So I grew up in Montreal, and the rules were, as far as we understood it, I could play in the bar, but I had to go into the dressing room, which was just the place where they stored the beer in between sets. I wasn't allowed to be in the bar itself after, other than performing, right? So for 2 years, I was underage playing in bars like that, but it was completely legal. Not sure how my parents allowed that.
That was probably strict rules for Montreal, too.
Probably,
right?
Very strict,
Montreal, the home of public urination. how long have you lived here?
Since 1990.
And when you were younger, you toured.
Yeah, I toured all over Canada for 7 years with the band C Spot Run. And we used to come to Winnipeg a lot. It's the reason I'm here. Met my wife here, always loved Winnipeg, and ended up here after I left the music biz and went back to university. University of Manitoba.
University of Manitoba, yes. Other universities are available. we were talking about U of M before, and I was talking about their bright, spacious studio, and they've got a window looks out on the world. I'm supposed to give the weather throughout the show here, and after like an hour, I'm like, you know what? I don't really know. Is it 25 and sunny? It might be.
Yeah.
But, you know, it might be pouring rain because that's kind of, you know, seems to be what it's been what it's been doing. Are you Stephanie Westdahl and you and my good friend Bob?
Your good friend Bob, and we just added a fourth member, Kevin Jones. Very recently.
Are you playing out anywhere soon?
We are. We're playing at the Trans Canada Brewing Company on July 20th. We're playing Shannon's Irish Pub on July 26th.
And now this is an original tune, but you play a mix of.
We play mostly covers. You kind of have to. To gig around town, you know, and you know, like most bands, if you do any writing, you try to get away with as many originals as you can. But it's kind of a blend. So that part's always been the same.
Yeah. So do you have any other? What are your summer plans other than,
Well, because I'm from Montreal, I try to go out east every summer. So I'll be heading back out for a couple of weeks. My mom's still in Montreal, brother there. And be heading out to Montreal and then Maritimes.
Well, that's great. It's supposed to get nice. It's supposed to be like 30 degrees next week. Which I guess is not surprising because it's going to be Folk Fest and it's either 30 degrees and hot, or it's raining.
It's raining, yeah.
So,
exactly.
So that's good. I guess we're going to finally get some summer that, you know, everybody.
If it stops raining.
Yeah, everybody wants. And I'm one of those guys that, you know, I want summer until it's too hot and then I start complaining about it. But as a Winnipegger, that's my prerogative. Well, that is great. Yeah, you can check out Stephanie West, Doll and the Band, on July 20th at TransCanada Brewing. The book, which is called...
What's it called? Treaties, Lies, and Promises.
And that is comes out... We're not promoting the book. We're promoting the apology, but the book does come out in the fall. And
but we should have more conversations in the future about all of this stuff.
Yeah. Well, all of us or you and me?
You and me.
That is great.
But all of us as well.
I will take
I do want to talk to you more about your question about where the proceeds go, because I have something to talk about.
Awesome. Then come back when it's time to talk about that.
We will.
That is amazing. Thank you so much. Really appreciate
Thanks, Kelly, for having me.
Is there another song on here that...
That's the first one. There'll be more.
So there's no other...
Not yet.
No other songs by her...
Well,
she's got something else.
Yeah.
There's some old stuff.
So her previous EP was Shabooba Burger EP, yeah, and the song Shabooba Burger is one that's gotten some attention.
Is it? Should we play that one?
Absolutely. Yeah.
Shabooba
Burger.
Shabooba Burger.
We played that one live too. It's an absolute blast.
Say that five times real fast without saying booger.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, we're gonna listen to Stephanie Westdahl, Shabooba Burger, and we're going to have Tom Brodbeck back on in the future when he's going to talk about the next things he's working on to make his corner of the world a better place.
Thanks for having me, Kelly. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Tom. Here is Stephanie Westdahl here on the Ivory Tower, CKUW 95.9 FM.
When you were just a small girl, you asked for everything in the world, and you got everything you wanted. So you ask, how long this ride goes on? I wish it could go on and on. Forever and ever, and just remember, hold on to the things that matter. It could be raining, rain could be falling down, and all the things you got won't help a lot. You gotta rise above, carry on, and listen to your heart. That you want. I hope you can find the love that you want. I hope you can find the love that you want. Hope you can find the love. Now you're out here on your own. The years have come and the days have gone. The fame you had is a setting sun. It's not the way you planned it. It could be raining, rain could be falling down, and all the things you got won't help a lot. You gotta rise above, carry on, listen to your heart. I hope you can find the love that you want. You want. I hope you can find the love that you want. I hope you can find the love that you want. I hope you can find the love that you want. I hope you can find the love that you want.